The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 238.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hi guys, welcome to this evening's live stream. I am in Cape Coral, Florida. As of right now, the land of the free. At least a little subsection, a little ecosystem of freedom between here and Naples. Although Naples is even better than here. Naples is the best I've seen, probably the best place in the world to be right now. But everyone knows it, and it's impossible to get a place down there. So let's see. Let's talk about Rebel Capitalist Pro. We're pretty much sold out for Rebel Capitalist Live. Only a couple of tickets left, but Rebel Capitalist Pro is the investment forum I have with my good friends Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. It's got their research, a forum for members to interact, go back and forth, and live streams just like this, where you can ask the pros, Lynn and Chris, questions directly, and you can also ask the amateurs, a guy like George Gammon. You can ask him questions directly as well. So check it out. My digital marketing guy, Gene, has an offer going. We've had it for quite a few months now. $1 trial offer. You can't beat it. Check it out at georgegammon.com/pro. All right. Let's get into your questions. Is there any cons to having a dual citizenship with U.S. and Canada? It depends if you're Canadian or from the U.S. If you're Canadian, yeah, there's some serious cons. You're going to get scooped up into the U.S. tax net for the rest of your life. You don't want that. So if you're a U.S. citizen, no, there's no real downside to having a Canadian passport. But in fact, a Canadian passport would be great because then you'd have the option of renouncing your U.S. passport and then get out of that tax system, but then still have visa-free travel into the U.S. So, again, just for clarity here, if you're a U.S. citizen, it would be fantastic to get a Canadian passport. If you're a Canadian citizen, it would be horrible to get a U.S. passport. So there you go. Okay, more USD, fewer goods and services, inflation, but what if it's spent on Chinese imports, then used by China to buy U.S. debt, is inflation limited to financial assets? Is inflation? Listen, I don't know how anyone could go to the grocery store or go to a restaurant, try to buy something, try to rent a house, try to buy a house, try to buy a car. You know what's interesting? Is just some more anecdotal evidence. I've been trying to buy a car for Florida, and I've been going on cars.com and cargurus.com. And one of the sites, you can choose listings that are like less than 90 days, something like that. I think it might be cars.com. And when you go on there and pull up all the car, and you don't give it any parameters, so you're just looking at all the ads, and then you see some cars that you're like, oh, that's a pretty good deal, that's a fair price, and then you click on it, the ad is like a year old, and you start to notice that every single time you see a decent deal or fair price for the car, the ad is a year old. And then you go ahead and do a search specifically by ads that have gone live within the last like 60 days. And then you do a search by lowest price. And the lowest price for a car now, you know, the same grouping of cars, same brand, same mileage, same model and whatnot. The lowest price now is like 20% higher than the prices 6 months ago. And I know I've been reading a few articles that have talked about how used car prices have just gone ballistic, along with commodities. We all know the story of lumber. But I mean, you know, fewer goods and services. Another thing you've got to understand is we can't really export or import services. So, yeah, you can import goods, but then you've got supply chain issues. You've got, you know, you've got producers there that are increasing their prices because it's costing them more to ship it over. So you have this really trickle through all of the supply chains when you have these shortages. And then you have, to look at the demand equation. Let's go back to the example of a car. So say, and I had this conversation with Bob Murphy the other day on the Rebel Capitalist show. So let's just pretend for a moment that the government created $1 million for every person in the United States and just sent it to them tomorrow. Well, what would happen? Let's say you wanted to go down to the local car dealership and buy that truck you always wanted. Okay, well, there's going to be another 100 people there that are doing the exact same thing. And what's going to happen? The dealer is just going to take the highest bid. And the highest bid, who knows, let's say the truck was a $30,000 truck. Well, who knows what the highest bid is? Everyone's got $1 million. The highest bid could be 500 grand. So prices immediately adjust higher because everyone has more currency units. So obviously that's an extreme example, but it helps you understand what happens when the average income of Americans goes up by over 20%. In March. I'm not making, you know, that's not George Gammon's statistic. That's straight from the Bureau of Economic Analysis. Go to their website. You can see the statistics right there. Just in the month of March alone, average incomes in the United States went up by over 20%. Then you have to ask yourself the question, are we creating more goods and services right now? Or fewer goods and services? We are definitely creating fewer services, that's for sure. So those prices go up. And even to your point, if we are producing fewer goods, but yet we're just importing those goods from China, it's not like we're importing way more goods to balance out the prices when we have excess demand or extra demand because of the currency units being printed. So it's not like we have more supply coming online to counterbalance the increase and call it M2. So now whether the inflation is transitory, which a lot of smart people seem to think, or whether it's permanent, and we've had a structural change. And I wouldn't want to say a structural change. So I think we've had consumer price inflation for quite some time. It hasn't been captured by the CPI. But whether you've got a change to the point where the CPI is really going to start increasing as well as the prices in the real world, you know, have we started to turn and go the other direction? Will we see something that looks a lot more like the 1970s instead of something that's looked a lot like the last, call it 10 years? I don't know. But what I do know is prices over the last 6 months have gone to crazy town, just gone completely bananas. Even I just tweeted out today when I went through Starbucks, they had a sign just stating that they're out of a lot of stuff because of global supply chain disruptions. They don't even have it at any price. You know, many of you heard the story that I told the other day on the Rebel Capitalist channel when I was doing one of the live streams. I can't recall which it was, but I was telling the story of how I went out to dinner on Friday night and we couldn't even order. It took us like an hour just to order. And the manager kept coming by the table and apologizing. And why was he short staffed? They can't get anyone to work. And then one of the local people we were having dinner with was saying that one of the nicest restaurants in town is having to close one day a week. We said, well, why is that? Is business slow? He says, no, quite the opposite. Business is booming. Okay, well, why do they have to close one day a week? Because they can't get anyone to work. I mean, these are economic distortions like we have never seen. I can't recall, there's no way there's been a time in U.S. history, I'm trying to think of other countries, where the government has created so many currency units and has literally paid people to stay home, paid people not to go to work, and where the government is actually competing directly with employers. It's beyond bizarre, beyond bizarre. And you're seeing shortages and you're seeing increased demand at all ends of the economic spectrum. It's not like you're just seeing it with high-end rental properties in Naples or $30,000 trucks. I mean, one of my great buddies from college has been a car dealer since we got out of college. He owns his own little used car lot where he sells about, I don't know, maybe 30 or so cars per month. And the typical car he sells is nothing fancy. It might sell it between $3,000 and $5,000. That's usually the type of car that he sells. It's like a 10-year-old Toyota Prius or something like that. That's like the normal type of car he would sell. Just something that most people kind of on the lower economic ladder or scale are in the market for. And so he's really got his finger on the pulse. You talk to him, what are prices doing? Same thing. He is making money hand over fist because he had so much inventory that he'd purchased like 3 or 4 months ago. And since then, the prices have just skyrocketed. And now he's selling all that inventory and the prices at the auctions haven't caught up yet. Now, obviously, at some point, the prices at the auctions are going to catch up. But he's in that little window where the prices at the auctions are still what they were kind of 3 months ago. But he's selling to retail where they're willing to pay almost any price for anything. And it's that same scenario that I told you, but just to a lesser degree. And what I'm referring to is everyone just getting $1 million and then going out and trying to buy a car. There's so many buyers that the price just goes up, 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 up almost immediately. It's exactly what we're seeing. So, I mean, even if you're in the deflation camp as far as asset deflation long term, I think that if you're not acknowledging the consumer price inflation that we're seeing over the past few months, I think you just got your head in the sand. I really do. But that's not to say that we can't have, that prices can't plateau and start coming back down. You know, we could have 10% increase in prices this year and then start to have disinflation where we have 8% the next year, 6% the next year, 5% the next year. See, there's no playbook for this, really. And it's all a matter, because why? Because it's not really an economic question. It's more of a political question. How much money are they going to create? How many more stimulus packages are we going to get? How much of that debt is the Fed going to monetize? What is that going to do to M2? At what point in time are the commercial banks going to start lending money again to the extent that they were lending money prior to the GFC? Will that even happen? Because let's remember, the commercial banks historically have been the ones that are in charge of the dollar as far as creating new money. So what's been happening is they've been creating a lot less money, but the government and the Fed have been creating a lot more money. So if the commercial banks decide that they want to do a 180 and create more money because we have this booming economy that's absolutely on fire, then what is M2 going to do? And what's interesting is, you know, I had a chart of the Reichsmark, the German currency, between 1918 and 1924. And this is basically compared to gold. So the marks that were backed by gold. Okay, so basically you're comparing it to gold. So as this line goes up, the fiat currency is depreciating because it's saying that it's taking more of these fiat currency units to buy one of the gold marks, or let's just call it 1 ounce of gold to make the thought experiment easy. So you see, at the beginning of 1918, it was almost a 1-to-1. By the time we got to 1920, it took 10 fiat currency units to buy one, basically, unit of gold. But look what happened here. See, the seeds of hyperinflation were sown way back in 1914, and they continued to increase the money supply tremendously through 1917, 1918, 1919, 1920, even 1921 to the beginning of 1922. It's not like they stopped the increase of money supply from 1920 to the end of 1921. But look what happened. The fiat currency actually appreciated against the gold unit from the beginning of 2020 till call it the end of 2021. Because when this line is going down, that means the fiat currency, it's taking you fewer of those fiat currency units to buy one unit of gold. Therefore, they're gaining value. But think through the timing. If you saw that and you're like, oh my gosh, this is an economic miracle. We are creating all of these currency units and our currency is actually appreciating against gold. So if the banks see this and society sees this, they're like, wow, this is a free lunch. We can print up all this money and we never have to worry about inflation ever again. Inflation is dead, and no more than 1 year later. 1 year later, the currency went from gaining value against gold to quite literally being toilet paper in 1 year. Do you think the people, the Germans and the foreigners that were holding marks, by the way, during this time frame, had any clue what was about ready to hit them? And my theory is that the commercial banks were probably hesitant to lend during this time frame because they saw this. You know, do you want to lend if you see inflation coming down the road and you see this inflation? But then what happens right here is inflation starts to level out. And the banks, the commercial banks, say, well, maybe we were worried about nothing. We want to take part of this economic miracle, this boom. So we're going to start lending to anyone that can fog a mirror. You want a house? Boom, you got a loan. You want a, I don't know if they had cars back then, but you want a car, you want whatever, here's a loan, here's a loan, here's a loan, here's a loan, here's a loan. So then you had that commercial bank lending that kicked in on top of the government money creation that was already going into hyperdrive. Why? Because we never have to worry about inflation ever again. We have an economic miracle. We've discovered that we're no longer held hostage by this belief system that deficits and government sovereign debt matter. anymore. We've realized that we are a currency issuer. We're not a currency user. Where have you heard that before? I'll bet you've heard that quite a bit over the past year and a half. I'll bet you've heard that quite a bit from people, economists, that have the ear of a lot of the politicians on the left, that since we are a currency issuer, we never have to worry about inflation, or we shouldn't worry about inflation right now. And if there's something that needs to be spent, if we need to spend another $10 trillion on stimmies, another $20 trillion on infrastructure, another $100 trillion, we're not constrained. We can just create the money. We're a currency issuer. And we shouldn't have to worry about inflation, because we haven't seen inflation, at least 1970s inflation, for the last few decades, out of sight, out of mind. Just like it was for the Germans between 1918 and the end of 1921. Let me tell you one more story to put things into perspective, and then we'll get back to the live stream and answering questions. I know that's why you guys are here. I read, I can't remember the article or as maybe in a book, but they said that the total amount of currency units, Reichsmarks, on the planet, not just in Germany, on the planet Earth, right around, call it this time, excuse me, call it the end of 1921, was around 180 billion. I don't have it right in front of me, so that it could be a different number, but it was something like that. So let's just say that it's 180 billion Reichsmarks that exist on planet Earth right around here. If you fast forward 1 year into the future, it would have cost you 180 billion marks to buy one newspaper. That's how fast the inflation genie can get out of the bottle. In today's world, just to give you some context, that would, let's just assume that all the dollars in the world equal what the Fed tells us M2 money supply is. Now, as you guys know from watching my videos, there are a lot more dollars outside of the United States than there are inside the United States. But just for this thought experiment, let's just say that the M2 money supply as measured by the Fed is 100% of the dollars that exist. Well, you guys know that M2 money supply is right around, we'll call it 20 trillion. So what this is like, what the experience in Germany was like, would be if 1 year from today, so in May of 2022, a newspaper would cost you $20 trillion. Again, that's how fast the genie can get out of the bottle. Yet the MMTers claim that we get a little inflation, no problem. All you got to do is raise taxes a little bit and you get that inflation genie right back in the bottle. Really? You think that if they would have just raised taxes right here in Weimar Germany, that they never ever would have had hyperinflation? So off on a little tangent there, but I thought it was appropriate, because I'm not saying that we're going through hyperinflation right now. I'm not saying that at all. We could go through a disinflationary period if they don't spend any more money, the government, with the Fed monetizing it, creating more currency units. I think we could definitely see an asset price deflation for sure, because things are so overextended. Remember, in the 1970s, the stock market went down from 72 to 74 in nominal terms by over 50%. So I'm not saying that we're there. I'm just saying this is what happened in history. And so I think we need to be cognizant of that when we are trying to think through the probabilities of what may or may not happen in the future and try to get our heads around the economic distortions that are being created right now.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
How to avoid our kids going through the whatever you want to call it, the cervasive sickness against the, oh, okay. So I think they're trying to say cerveza. Okay. And are not outlawed from school. The government can't. What a difficult question to answer. I don't know. I mean, there are just there are no good options with that. I mean, obviously, if you've got the means to homeschool, that's what I'd suggest. Or if you can put your kids in private school, I think that's far less likely. But I understand that not everyone has the ability to do that. So if you don't have the ability to do that, I mean, I'd try to move to a state where that wasn't going to happen. But like Idaho is an example. I'd be shocked if they allowed that in Idaho. But who knows? I mean, after what we've seen in 2020 and 21, I don't know. I just feel sorry for you. I mean, I really do feel bad because I'm not a parent, but if I was, I don't know what I'd do there. I would be just between a rock and a hard place. And it's a very unenviable position. And I just feel bad that because of the circumstances and because of what the government is doing, that you even have to make that decision. Yeah, this is another kind of off-topic question, but definitely relevant. How does one maintain a better mental health in these challenging times? Understanding macro to the extent that we do, that most of the people on this channel watching this video understand it, it's a blessing and a curse. It really is. It's very much like the Matrix with the red pill and the blue pill. And that pretty much all of us on this live stream right now have chosen to take the economic red pill. So when you go out and see, you know, like to a restaurant, like that story I told a Friday night, you see things that other people just don't see. Everyone else there is just enjoying their beer and having some hamburger and maybe the view. And yeah, you've got to wait an hour to order, but who cares? I'm here with my friends. I'm just enjoying a Friday night. I wish I could enjoy that Friday night. But I'm sure you guys can relate that while you're sitting there waiting, you're thinking to yourself, how is this affecting the economy? What's the end game here? You're seeing the economic distortions play out in real life. And although you want to enjoy yourself and have a lot of fun, and you try to, in the back of your mind, you're seeing the writing on the wall, and you're like, you because you've taken the red pill, you understand that what you're seeing is not good. Where everyone else there just is kind of, it's ignorance is bliss, right? They haven't taken the red pill. They're blue-pilled, if you want to continue to use that analogy. So they're still just stuck in that pod with their not knowing, not conscious, not aware of the fact that their brain is just plugged into a computer simulation. And obviously I'm talking about the movie. But it's the same thing with the people that are living in the world today that haven't taken the economic red pill. What they see around them as reality. Everyone on this live stream right now knows is further from reality than the people who thought reality was the computer simulation in the movie. And we all know that if we continue down this path of government overreach and building an entire economy around government spending stimulus and having government spending as a larger and larger percent of GDP, we all understand that doesn't end well. And so that's what I'm talking about. And, you know, it's a blessing in the sense that you're not whistling by the graveyard. And I always say that you've got two choices. You can either be prepared or you're going to be a victim. So it's a blessing in the sense that we can prepare for the inevitable, I guess, but it's always a matter of timing. When I say inevitable, I'm not talking about inflation or deflation. I'm talking about at some point in time, this game of musical chairs with these asset bubbles has to come to an end. At some point in time, whether it's the inflationary medicine to get the excessive debt out of the system, or if it's a deflationary medicine, we're going to have to go through that time frame of severe pain and withdrawals, like that heroin addict. You know, the analogy Schiff always uses, that's fantastic, that the heroin addict, they've got to go through rehab and amount to them getting more and more and more of the drug. Rehab is them going cold turkey and going through a month or two of hell to get their health back before they can start to become healthy again. And it's pretty much the same thing with our economy. And so my point is, it is advantageous for us to be aware of what is happening behind the scenes. See, you and I can look out over the ocean and understand that there is a tsunami that's coming into shore that other people just can't see. The blue pill economic crowd, your friend and family member Fred, they look out over the ocean and all they see is calm water. And you guys sit there and say, oh no, but there's a tsunami that's coming right toward the land. And as soon as that burst of energy that's going through the water gets closer and closer to the shore, that wave comes up and you just can't see it yet. You see, that's a blessing, like I've been saying, but it's also a curse because it's difficult to detach yourself from understanding that our economy and therefore the standard of living of your friends, of your family members, of the people you care about is at some point in time going to have to decrease dramatically. I think what I would try to do is understand that you can't worry about things you can't control. It's just pointless. So get super focused on what you can control. That's your own environment, your kids, your wife, your husband, you know, that your family unit, and get control of your finances. And try to educate as many of your friends and family members as you can. But if they tell you to go pound sand because they prefer the blue pill, there's nothing you can do about that. And it's out of your control. So you can't worry about it. You can't let it stress you out. Because at the end of the day, life is too short. And you know, also too, at the end of the day, I guess it's really not, the happiness, I guess, shouldn't be completely measured by standard of living. Now, obviously, if you can't put food on the table, like you have a Venezuela type situation, then that's going to bring down the level of overall happiness. But, you know, if we go back to the standard of living that we had in the 1940s, 50s, let's say, it's not like that would be horrific, wouldn't be great, but, you know, there's still, you still enjoy your kids, you still enjoy the things that you enjoy now. So I guess that's how I'd get by it. And as far as the simple things, you got to exercise. I know it kind of sounds kind of woo-woo-y, but I mean, I think you got to exercise. You got to get out and jog. You got to do some cardio to get the endorphins or whatever is released in your brain to get you in a good frame of mind. You not only have to do that to keep your spirits up, but I think you also have to do it to make sure you're thinking clearly and you're able to, you know, maximize on your capacity to think. And so that's probably what I'd suggest. That's what I try to do. What mining stocks are you looking at? I'm not looking at mining stocks right now. I bought a bunch back in 2020 in March, and I haven't had time. I just haven't had time. I like mining. I like the gold miners right now. I'm not buying, but I would definitely put them on a watch list. I think they're one of the very few things that are cheap, relatively speaking, maybe not compared to, you know, a long-term chart of gold adjusted for inflation, but I think that they definitely could be interesting right around here. They're definitely forgotten and unloved. And that's not the only prerequisite for me buying, but it's definitely sparks my attention. It gets me looking. 95% of my portfolio is in physical gold, 5% silver. Bad idea. Yes, that's a bad idea. You don't want to be that concentrated. It's just, that doesn't make any sense to me. Plus, you're in, look at, so what has to happen in order for you to make money is you not only have to have price appreciation, but you have to have price appreciation above and beyond the rate of inflation. So you've got basically a portfolio that's just completely hedged. And not only that, let's just say that gold goes to 10,000 an ounce. And then you say, oh my gosh, well, I hope so, because then I would be rich. Well, would you? Let's say gold goes up to $10,000 an ounce over the next 2 years, but the rate of inflation goes up at the same rate. But the rate of inflation goes up equally to the rate of the increase in price of the gold you hold. Well, did you increase your purchasing power? No. In fact, you decreased your purchasing power, because then you got to sell your gold if you want to take the gold and turn it into purchasing power. And then you're going to get smoked with taxes. I mean, who knows what the cap gains tax will be in 3 years? It could be 90%. So you see what I'm saying? So then you have to ask yourself the question, what would have to happen in order for gold to exceed the rate of inflation? And that may or may not happen. I think that's why I always consider gold as good insurance. That's the insurance side of the portfolio. But to have 100% basically in gold, I mean, and in a world, by the way, where gold goes to, let's say, 10,000, what happens to oil, right? Like, what happens to oil producers in that world? And would it be better to take some of that 95% and buy an oil producer that actually pays you to own it? See? If you're getting that's why I do a 10-80-10 portfolio, where 10% is gold, but 80% are investments defined by owning something that pays me to own it. So like an oil producer, as an example, where you're getting an 8-10% dividend yield. And then you can hold, you don't have to sell your gold. You don't have to sell your asset. You just get the cash flow. And then let the asset itself just hedge your purchasing power of the initial investment. So it's a bad idea to have anything 100%. And what is your opinion on investing as a limited partner on a platform like CrowdStreet, where they screen out 90%? I wouldn't do that. I don't like that. And I'm not saying it's bad. I just personally, you're asking me about what I like and don't like. I don't like other people being in control of my investment. And I mean, you're doing that to a degree when you invest in a company, because the CEO or the management team is in charge of basically your investment, because you're buying an equity share in the business itself. But that's as far as I like to go. I don't like to give my money to a fund manager, a financial planner. Definitely not something where they're just crowdsourcing money. I don't like that. I mean, I can't imagine the spreads they're taking. And then I think at some point in time, the whole crowdfunding thing to buy real estate or whatever, I think that might struggle in the future. But that's just my opinion for my personal portfolio. I'm not saying that for other people it might not be a smart play, but I wouldn't want to be any part of it. Is it a terrible time to build a house because of sky-high supply costs and bubble pricing, or is house built now cheap in 5 years due to inflation? Well, it's not cheap, because you've got to look at the prices of building costs adjusted for inflation. And it's crazy, crazy, crazy expensive. So there's nothing cheap about housing right now other than the 30-year fixed rate mortgage. That's the only cheap part of the housing market right now. I mean, does that mean that you, I'm not saying that you shouldn't buy the, build the house, but you've got to realize if you build a house or buy a house right now, you're buying a liability. Usually that would be an asset on your balance sheet, and I would consider it a liability right now. Why? Because you're buying something that's wildly expensive, or you're even building something that's wildly expensive. When you look at the input costs adjusted for inflation and what their historical norm is over, let's say, the last 40 or 50 years. I mean, look at, again, lumber prices, look at that. That's a perfect example. That's one of your main input costs. Labor, look at labor. In fact, I just got a bid to remodel one of my properties in Kansas City. And I looked at it and I was just, I almost fell on the floor. The bids were so high. And after going through the bids and trying to say, why on earth are they so just ridiculously high? It's labor. Because with a remodel, you know, I don't have a lot of lumber in there. It's just your labor costs are through the roof. Can't get workers. You're competing with the government. So, you know, I'm not saying don't do it. I'm just saying if you do it, make sure you understand that the property is a liability on your balance sheet and the 30-year fixed rate mortgage is the asset on your balance sheet. See? And if you're doing this with cash, that's I think you're playing with fire there. That's not to say that you won't make money, but it's just to say that if you use that strategy long term, the odds are against you. Because what you're doing is you're buying expensive and hoping to sell to someone when the bubble has increased in size, as opposed to buying things when they're cheap and then selling them when they're expensive. You're trying to buy them when they're expensive and just sell them when they're even more expensive. And it's not to say that that won't work. It's just to say that if you do that 1,000 times, the probability is that you will lose money. Now, if you buy cheap and sell expensive, or if that's your strategy, then it's not like you're going to make money every single time. But if you do that 1,000 times, now you've got an edge. So the law of large numbers is in your favor. It's going back to blackjack, like you guys know I always do. So the law of large numbers is in your favor if you're always trying to buy cheap and sell expensive. And you might not make money every time, but over the long run, you're going to come out ahead. All right, guys, let me go ahead and do some shout outs. I appreciate you hanging out with me. I think, whoa, we got almost 1,250 people. That's awesome. Jack P, thanks for hanging out. Alan Mersk, Jay Hike, Alan Zibelman, Ann Cooper, Cynthia Aiken, Robbie Humble, Cheesy Chaz, Truth, Christopher Erickson, James P, Systems Reality Team, Becky B, Pork Barrel Investing in the house, Anthony Court, my good buddy in the house, Lloyd Braun, Terry Bello, Value Stonks, Angelique, All Nighter Hider, Terry Balu, Joseph Gerard, Self Defense for Kids. Like I got it. America Soap, Gregory Mannarino Jr. my good buddy, Greg Mannarino. All right, Rod Mula and, oh, no, skipped all over. We got Ralph Martinez, Arias, Mac, skipped again. All right, guys, enjoy the rest of your evening, and I will see you on the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.